Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome everybody to another edition of CMC Radio. I'm your host, Rob May. I hope everybody's having a good Wednesday morning so far. I haven't made it too far into the day just yet, I know, but hopefully everybody has a great day. Joining me today, very excited to have back Dr. Mark Rasik out of Farmington Hills, Michigan. Dr. Rasik, how you doing today?
Good, thank you.
Great. Well, it's great to have you back on the show now for this is part three of a four-part series that we'll be doing with Dr. Rasik. And obviously, you know, Dr. Rasik is a cardiologist, has been in the healthcare industry doing some great things, and we've talked about how he kind of approaches his patients probably somewhat differently than many other doctors, making himself available, which sounds a little bit more often than most doctors would like. but as far as introducing himself, who better to do that than the man himself? Dr. Rasik, tell us a little bit about your background briefly, just to bring everybody up to speed.
Sure. I'm an interventional cardiologist, means I do heart catheterizations, angioplasties, stents, that type of thing, but also do general cardiology, preventative medicine, and internal medicine. So we try to keep busy with, the whole body and mind.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And now, you brought up the actual procedures that you do, and I'm curious to know, because I'm obviously not in healthcare, and unless I think you unfortunately have to go through some of this stuff, people probably don't know what that is. So when you say a heart catheter, what is that about?
That's where we image the heart and its structures, including the coronary arteries, by accessing through one of the arteries, either through the leg or the wrist, to go and take pictures to see if there's any blockages that might need fixing.
And as far as if you see a blockage, do you personally then do a procedure that would have to, open that up?
Usually, I will do it in the same setting. Unless there's some reason not to, I try to do it all in one setting so the patient doesn't have to come back for another one.
Sure.
But sometimes in the case, whether it's a technical difficulty, special equipment, or any other issues, we may have to come back for a second time.
Now, is any type of procedure where you have to open up someone's chest, is anything like that risky at all?
Well, I mean, everything carries a risk, even the most straightforward procedure. And the old adage, if you haven't had a complication, you haven't done enough of things. Statistically, when we say there's a 1 in 1,000 chance of having some issue with the procedure, it's a low number overall, but that one person, it's still 100% to them. So I try not to overemphasize the bad outcomes, but I don't try to sweep under the couch the fact that these are interventional procedures. Everything has to be weighed for the risk versus benefit.
Sure. And is that something that you do go over with every patient before you do anything like that?
Oh, absolutely.
Has anybody ever told you, okay, I'm not going to do it because of the chance there, or no?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Wow. Absolutely. And the patients that usually will say no, or they don't want to endure the risk versus, the benefit, those are typically the ones that are, for the most part, not as symptomatic as the others. So, they tend to actually sort themselves out. Most patients that have ongoing symptoms and really aren't doing well or it's interfering with their lifestyle, they're willing to have the procedure just to make their lives better. But, you have to sort things out because there's the elective procedure, which we do to make people feel better, and then there's the emergency procedure where the patients are actually dying and you have to save them. So it's a different sort of animal on each step, but the elective ones, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of them that would rather not go on.
Sure. But now, so you said that you do actual, emergency work on the heart then. What's going on in those scenarios? What type of symptoms are people seeing when it's like a obviously an emergency for you to have to get in there?
Well, a majority of them are patients that are having onset that's new of chest pain and EKG changes that show they're having an ongoing heart attack. So those are the
wow.
patients we take to the cath lab. We open up the artery, and in those cases, those are people that the sooner we get in, the more heart muscle we salvage, and the better they do, and that's a life-saving procedure.
Wow. And is it hard for you to kind of, I mean, because I don't want to get too personal if
mm-hmm.
you don't want to answer this, but as far as, you know, if, God forbid, you lose a patient in that scenario, is it hard for you to kind of separate yourself from them? I mean, obviously, you're a human being, and you're...
Right. I during the actual procedure, it's an artery, and it's an objective. I pride myself on keeping calm, keeping everybody around me
right.
calm, getting the
right,
job
right.
done. If despite our best efforts, the patient expires, it's awful. It's to
right.
go have to tell family that this is the problem. And
mm-hmm.
and many times it's because the patient didn't come in, or maybe perhaps it was just misinterpreted. The symptoms they were having the whole time have been sort of misdiagnosed at home. Those are the tough ones to go to, especially young ones with family members and children and that kind of stuff waiting in the waiting room. So it doesn't happen very often, but it's awful.
Absolutely. Do you take that home with you? I mean, I know you're saying it's awful, but does it ever weigh on you that you could have done something different or somebody should have done something? I mean, do you get passionate about a scenario like that? I mean, how do you kind of handle it?
Usually I'll try to leave that at the hospital. So I may respond to it in a passionate fashion there, but try not to bring that home to my wife and five kids.
Sure.
They have enough of their own drama. And
it is occasionally
problematic in that you know, a wife wants you to take things at home seriously,
right.
bedtimes and homework and that type of stuff. And then when you just lost a young patient, maybe even around Christmas time or something, to say, well, you know, he didn't eat his vegetables, probably doesn't compare with who just lost, you know, a patient with five kids at home. You know, so I have to make sure that I see things from her perspective and not minimize them because of what I just went through.
Of course, yeah, absolutely. And so basically, I mean, we want to keep people away from that situation. We don't want you to have to deal with that.
Right.
So when the overall question is, when should people start caring about their heart health, their health in general? I mean, what's the age when they should start, you know, stop living like a young person and start really being responsible with themselves?
Well, see, that's part of the problem is we all think there's a magic age,
right.
and that's not necessarily the case, although the numbers go up after a certain age group. For men, it's in the 40s and women in 50s. But, you know, we've had enough data that we know this starts at youth. And there are patients that are getting, you know, they're pediatric patients that are being defined as obese and getting cholesterol and glucose and insulin levels drawn to try to head this off from a young toddler on up. And it
right.
was unheard of before. Then we've had, you know, autopsies done on Vietnam and Korean vets that are 19 years old. They had atherosclerosis. So we know that this isn't something that just happens after age 40. It's something that occurs probably lifelong, and that's why I think there's this big push to have healthier food and cafeterias, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And now, we spoke about how recommended levels have changed over the years. In last
right.
episode, you know, with cholesterol and such. But now, when it comes to that, for today's standards, you know, you mentioned obesity and the high level that we have, obviously, in our youth. But aside from, you know, changing the cafeteria policies that they have, you know, limiting the amount of French fries and fried and fatty foods, obviously, I mean, what else can parents really do to keep their children healthy?
I think, you know, physical activity is huge, and that's a big problem. That when programs get cut, most of the time it's the sports, the physical activity
sure.
programs. So those are the ones that need to, you know, these kids need to get back out there, get out, and play for so many minutes or at least hours a day to get physically active, because the computers, the text messaging, and then the these computer games are causing a sedentary lifestyle that is not healthy.
Right. Absolutely. And so, you know, does age matter, though, in terms of how much exercise you need or how much of certain foods that you need? Does it change from your youth to, you know, becoming an adult? I mean, you know, are there recommendations that you need to follow? You know, so you're, you know, before you're 18 years old, you should be exercising this much or eating this much of that. And then after that, you know, does the levels change?
Well, I mean, they do to a certain extent, because you can't expect somebody who's 70 or 60 to be able to do the same amount of activity as a young person.
Right.
But and the young people tend to eat a little bit more of the junk food. So if they are, it's sort of individualized. If you got an obese, you know, 15-year-old who's eating empty calories, pop, and that type of stuff. You know, those are the guys that we need to intervene on, because the statistics clearly show they become obese adults and diabetics and that type of thing. So those guys need a little more intensive there. But for the adults, for sure, you know, if we get 30 minutes to an hour of at least moderate activity 5 out of 7 days, then that's ideal.
All right. So 5 out of 7 days, everybody, do something for at least 30 minutes,
yep.
Please.
You got it. You got it. And if nothing else, you know, try not to take the elevator. Park your car an extra,
right.
You know. So any activity is good, but really it's the aerobic activity where you're reaching a target heart rate that you're going to get your greatest benefit.
Right. And is there such thing as really overworking yourself? I mean, because you always hear about these, and I use the term very, very politely, gym rats. That spend hours and hours and hours in the gym, they say, doing all this different type of exercises, you know, probably about 5 to 7 days a week. I mean, is there anything that's too much? Can you do damage of, you know, with too much activity?
Yes, there is overuse syndrome, and
mm-hmm.
and it absolutely, and a lot of these athletes that are bikers and that type of stuff, they get hip replacements. Some of the guys that are lifting weights heavier than they should tend to cause, you know, tendons and tendinopathies, as well as, just, you know, especially if they're using enhancing medications like anabolic steroids.
Right.
Those are particularly dangerous because, you know, A, they're much stronger muscle-wise than their frames can handle, so it tends to be, you know, your body can only lift so much, and it's a defense mechanism to keep you from destroying a joint or from
right.
dislocating. When you have that strength, but the structure can't hold it, those gentlemen or ladies get into deep trouble, not to mention the side effects of those.
Sure. I mean, is that something that also you've seen firsthand as far as
sure.
any of your patients?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, but it's tough. It's those enhancing between the stimulants and the anabolic steroids. It's a toxic combination for the heart.
Wow. And so, I mean, how severe are the effects of it? I mean, does it happen very quickly? Is it something that
no? It's usually gradual. It's usually gradual, and you know, it affects the liver. It affects the heart. It affects the cerebral vascular system. It affects blood pressure. You know, the entire hormonal system is turned upside down. So those are problems with these things, but they do what they're advertised. And so when you are a gym rat, as you so adequate acquaintance put it, these are guys that are, you know, with them, and they become supermen on this. So I get comments like, I know what you're saying, Doc, but if you had a drug that would make you 10 times smarter as a doctor or 100 times smarter, wouldn't you want to use it? And you know, my answer is always the same: not if it put my life in jeopardy. And
sure.
And these guys are. And so now, once their hearts are in trouble, especially the ones with weak hearts, and they're still lifting 350 pounds worth of weight, it's too much of a strain on the heart.
Right. Now, what is the actual effect from those drugs on the heart? What are they doing to it?
Well, they can cause multiple episodes of cardiomyopathy, has been documented, a weak heart. They cause sodium and water retention, which can cause heart failure. There's good data that shows that it accelerates atherosclerotic changes. So, you know, I mean, those are just a few items, because a lot of times the heart is also taking on the side effects of the liver damage that it does. And again, these huge weights that they're lifting, it doesn't make the heart stronger. It just makes your axial muscles, the muscles on your arms and legs, stronger. So the heart still has to bear the brunt of lifting something it probably shouldn't have to deal with, because it's not normal for someone to be able to lift 350 to 400 pounds or 600 pounds. I mean, it's almost guaranteed when these guys are lifting the world's record weight, it's because they're enhanced. The human body isn't built like that normally.
Sure, sure. So anybody that thinks they're a comic book hero should maybe kind of put that dream on the side for a little bit.
yeah. It is, and I mean, these are just a few things that it causes, and not to mention the psyche, the mental issues, the hypogonadal, and you know, it's not good.
And again, it's something that I think you turn on the TV and you see it. I mean, it's in popular culture with sports, you know, from baseball to football to anything. You know, at least now they're starting to take the proper measures to cut it down.
Right.
And I think it's tough, though, when, you know, kids growing up see these guys that are huge and excelling in the sport, and then all of a sudden, you know, they find out, ooh, you know, that they weren't exactly playing fair.
Absolutely, and they rotator cuffs get destroyed, and then they become really thin because of the anabolic steroids. So they're, most of them are, a lot of times, if they go long enough, they're not even repairable.
Right. And for everyone just joining us now, I'm with Dr. Mark Rasek. Practices out of Farmington Hills, Michigan. You know, we're covering the topics of the health, topics of the heart. So moving along, Dr. Rasek, a big thing obviously is hereditary disorders and diseases. Now, does the heart, or I should say, do heart-related diseases or disorders, is it all hereditary? I mean, is it something that you can kind of read from somebody's family history?
Well, I mean, if it's a structural problem, like either the heart's weak or the heart is too thick or rigid, cardiomyopathies, type of things are genetic. We kind of have to just deal with what nature gave us. And some of these patients get transplanted, other patients get devices, other patients get surgery. There are some genetic disorders that cause cholesterol to build up in the coronaries and other vessels. So we do our best to keep the cholesterol down, the blood pressure down. So we can't alter Mother Nature, at least not yet. We can test for some of the genetic markers, which will help screen other family members. Right now, we're being able to diagnose by genetic testing, but not necessarily alter someone's genes to treat it.
And as far as that goes, then you mentioned altering a person's genes, right?
Right.
Now, is that totally impossible? I mean, down the road, even as a thought?
No. I mean, who would have ever thought we would be able to pick these things up now as we're unraveling the DNA and decoding and deciphering it? The first step is to pick up the diseases and find where there's a problem along the chain. Then.
Right.
Intervening and maybe even intervening in utero when the baby's, you know, not even born yet. That is, you know, it's probably a good 10 to 20 years down the line, but it is not, it's not going to be impossible.
Sure. And while we're on the topic, in your time as a doctor, you know, has the technology changed all that much?
The technology has been spectacular. I mean, it's not so much that the types of technology, it's the existing technology and how good. I mean, there was a day where most defibrillators or pacemakers were so big that you had to put them in your belly instead of in the chest. They lasted a few years and had to be replaced. Now they're wafer thin. You put them in the chest, they last years at a time. The amount of information they can store and interrogate is incredible. So it's one of those things where the data has really been driven. I mean, cardiology is probably one of the most progressive of all the specialties, because it was driven by a lot of thought leaders from the beginning. I mean, from the time Dr. Grenzig did the angioplasty in the 70s, where everyone thought if you put a balloon up in a coronary, they would die instantaneously.
Right.
To what they're doing now, where they're doing valve replacements over a catheter. It's a very aggressive, very smart and savvy group of physicians. So I'd say of all of them, of all the, you know, they don't wait for industry. These are doctors that go out, they investigate, they invent. It's a very very cool specialty to be in, because the thought leaders in medicine are there's a high concentration of them in our specialty.
And now I know we also mentioned blood pressure and cholesterol within the hereditary idea. So the big question for me is, because I've had some high blood pressure counts, you know, and I'm in my early 30s still, but when should people worry about high blood pressure?
Well, I mean, we have been... 140 over 90 was always considered or less good blood pressure. Well, you know, when we start looking at some of the data that's come in over the last 10 years, when we look at patients that have had blood pressures of 135 over 85, which would have been perfectly fine in the past, you know, we're now beginning to see two times the risk of heart attack, stroke, and death over the lifetime of that patient.
Right.
Though we begin to learn that the cholesterol buildup, you know, in the carotids correlates with cholesterol buildup in the coronaries. We realize that the sugars, when we were using 140 for a fasting sugar, those patients weren't doing as well as patients with a little bit tighter control. So utilizing the data that we have from generations ahead of us, we're beginning to realize what needs to be optimized. And there's certain studies that we could do to help. Like, for instance, patients that say they have white coat hypertension. It only goes up when they see their doctor. Well, if their echo shows their heart muscle is thick from high blood pressure, chances are it's not just at the doctor's.
Right.
We have ambulatory blood pressure cuffs, where people wear them for 24 to 48 hours. And if they tend to run higher than what we like for our guideline recommendations, then you know that that patient isn't just nervous when he sees you. I mean, real life evolves more than just going to the doctor. So I'm glad their blood pressure at home is 120 over 80 when they're watching TV. But the rest of the day, if they're at work, it tends to be higher. And when the heart, the kidneys, the eyes start feeling the strain of high blood pressure, high cholesterols, and high sugars, then usually it becomes evident either through their ophthalmologist, through their internist, maybe, you know, the kidneys have some protein spill in the urine. So, I mean, the key to a lot of this is actually seeing your primary care doctor and hoping that they're pretty thorough. I mean, that's a tough thing for them to know, but they should have a keen eye for these basic meat and potatoes type of risk factors, and be aware that there's a cumulative effect. So even borderline blood pressure, borderline sugars, borderline cholesterol, you know, these type of things, if they're sedentary, if they're a bit overweight, these all add not only cumulatively, but probably more than that, exponentially.
Right.
Because and there is risk scores, like the Framingham risk score, where it was a town in the East Coast where they watched patients with certain, you know, characteristics over 50 years, and these are the kind of things that we watched and said, okay, well, these patients with these risk factors over a 10-year time had a certain percentage, so there's a score for that. There's all sorts of risk stratification that we do. You never get to that point if you don't get to the doctor, and the doctor doesn't get a chance to sort of assess things.
Right. So then I should be kind of concerned and maybe push my primary doctor to allow me to take. Well, because it sounds like what you mentioned, the score of, you know, 140 over 90 or, you know, whatever, 130. Because basically for me on a personal level, it's been around 130 over 90. And she knew that I wasn't so into starting to take medication just yet.
Right.
But and she said if it hangs out around the 130 over 90 area, we won't start you on the medication just yet. We'll see if we can lower it a little bit. But again, I'm a moderately healthy guy. I mean, I'm pretty active. I definitely do the recommended 5 days a week, at least 30 minutes of exercise. But yeah, I mean, the blood pressure thing is a scary thing. You're making it a little scary for me.
Well, and so here's what I would do with someone like yourself, because this is where you know, there's certain very low sodium diets that are supposed to help, and that type of thing. It's called the DASH diet, DASH, all capital. But it's to most people a fairly unpalatable, really low sodium diet, and it may get a few millimeters of mercury lower. But for you, if I were to do a test such as like a stress echo, the ultrasound
right.
of the heart would tell me if your heart muscle has shown some strain from the high blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Then during peak exercise, we'd be able to see how high your blood pressure goes, because especially in someone like yourself, if you're out being active, which is a good thing, but your blood
right.
pressure is going up to 200 on that top number, then maybe that's not so good. And if the blood pressure and the heart looks like it's had some strain to it, then maybe a low dose of medication will protect you while you're out there.
Right. So medication is not always a necessary evil, but it does provide, I mean, it provides a guy like me who's, you know, like I said, I'm a little weary on starting to take medication for things at my age, because I'm, you know, not 40 years old yet. And, you know, I know that for my, like, let's say my mom and people, you know, in their 60s and such, you know, they're on different medications to keep control, different levels and stuff. And it's tough to see, and it's tough to think about right now for me.
You know, and it's understandable. I mean, but once you start eliminating secondary causes and we still have an issue, then that's the gene pool. And I'm 155 pounds. I don't sit and eat a bunch of fats, but my cholesterol is high. It's a genetic
right.
problem. My whole family has it.
Sure.
So I go on a statin. So, you know, knowing what your heart rate and blood pressure does and the structure and function of your heart at a peak exercise level, you know, especially in an active guy such as yourself, I think it's definitely worth doing.
Now, is that something that I could do with a primary doctor? Do you have to go to a specialist to get, like, the EKG?
Well, you know what? It depends. I mean, some of the specialists will have those services available to them through, you know, other private practices, or they may just have you go to the hospital and just say, you know, I'm working my patient up for hypertension, and I, you know, like to do a stress echo. And then it's very easy to do, because there's no IV, there's no radiation. They'll basically ultrasound your heart, put you on the treadmill, monitor your heart rate and rhythm and blood pressure while you go, and it gradually goes faster, and the incline goes up. And in the end, when you say, I've had enough, they take you off the treadmill, ultrasound your heart again, and then be able to get all the information that we would need.
Hmm. All right. So basically, I mean, it really boils down to, and you've mentioned this again, it's not fearing necessarily the methods and whatever it takes to kind of get it done, and just being realistic with yourself and with the doctor, obviously, about what it takes to get you healthy again.
Right. I mean, your body will compensate early on for just about anything you throw at it. But over time, if it's not corrected and it's left to sort of take its own, that's where you get into trouble. Once a heart
sure.
burns out because it's been dealing with high blood pressure for long periods of time, not necessarily in your case, but higher ones, it's very tough to put that genie back mm-hmm. in the bottle.
So with the low dose, we'll say, if someone my age were to start taking a low dose blood pressure medication,
mm-hmm.
now, is it possible for you just to take it for some time, get it down, and then it can just be healthy at that point?
Well, when a patient is already got a decent sort of physical where they're not mm-hmm. overweight, they're not on medications that may drive their blood pressure up, they're not in any
right.
unusual situation which may be causing their blood pressure to go up, there's no tumors producing any kind of endocrine issues or any of this other business that's exotic,
right.
chances are, you know, I'm going to be on my statin for life because my gene pool is not going to change anytime
gotcha,
soon.
Gotcha, yes.
Unless we can manipulate our genes, and that would be something that may be down the line, but I'm not sure how soon. So
sure.
the short answer is, if somebody is morbidly obese, they're eating high sodium foods, they're on medications that may be causing them problems, taking in too much caffeine or nicotine, I mean, those patients, theoretically, with weight loss and lifestyle modification, potentially could come off medications, just like many of the bariatric patients that get surgery.
Right.
But they may not. So I always warn those patients that even if you have bariatric surgery, I know the surgeon told you you can come off your insulin and all your medicines. Maybe, maybe not. We won't know how much of this is genetic until we fix the outside external forces.
Right. Well, unfortunately, Dr. Asik, we're running out of time for today's episode, but glad to say we got you coming back for one more, hopefully next week. So if you have a contact information or anything that you'd like to share with people to get in touch with you or reach out to you, please share it with us.
Sure. Best way is through my email. It's mrasik, R-A-S-A-K, mrasik at heartdoctors, and that's heartdrs.com.
All right. Well, Dr. Asik, I want to thank you again for coming on the show this morning, and we will talk to you hopefully next week. All right?
Sounds good, my friend. Be well.
All right, take care. Now, from everybody here at CMC Radio, this is Rob May saying we'll see you soon. Have a good one, everybody.